Avatar certainly has its, has a few low points, but for those critics who wished for fewer one-liners and evil caricatures, maybe we should wish for fewer of them in the world first, because they are still out there and they are still speaking the language they've always spoken. If James Cameron and the rest of us want to do something about it, let's start today. And this is from this is Josh Schrey, marketing director, strategist, producer, writer, critic, and activist. And it's from the Huffington Post. And I just when I read this, I was just like really, really impressed with like just. And I've seen Avatar twice.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM. Yes, Radio Free Thinker, the show that promotes skepticism and critical thinking. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
Hello, and I'm Don, political science and philosopher.
I'm Rob, cognitive psychologist.
And I'm Daniel, economics student.
And today we have a special guest, Dr. Chris Erickson, who's a professor here at UBC, and for full disclosure, one of my professors, who's going to be on our show talking about fear.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
So what's Don getting in your class?
Don't know yet. We'll wait until the midterm's done.
Very good.
Fear to control your grids.
No.
Well, so we got a great show today. We'll be starting off with a few interesting stories, and then we'll be talking to Dr. Chris about fear and security. Before we get to that, just a quick announcement. Maybe our listeners already know this, but CFI was recently questing for an executive director for their Vancouver branch, and I'm happy to say they picked me, so yay.
Congratulations, Ethan.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to putting on events and organizing, and I will plan on leaning heavily on my fellow Radio Free Thinkers, so it's going to be just as difficult for me as it is for them.
Oh boy!
And does that mean we get some of the honorarium too?
No. Oh. very direct on that one. So, what's going on in the world of science, technology, and skepticism?
I've got an interesting story I saw the other day, which absolutely proves evolution is false. Can't be true, because apparently there is a slug out there that's part plant and part animal. And a study that was published in The New Scientist, I believe, Mary Rumpo from the University of Maine, pointed out that there is a particular slug out there that eats algae and incorporates the chloroplast, that's sort of the part of the plant that photosynthesizes, and it incorporates into its body. And of course, that in itself is kind of weird, but other animals have done that. But what's really weird is, in order for these chloroplasts to work, you need certain chemicals and all that to do that. And it seems that this sea slug has somehow incorporated into its body plant genes so as to do the machinery to make these chloroplasts work. And it's quite bizarre. From what I understand, it's the first and only example of a plant-animal hybrid, barring the ones that might be in some genetically modified lab somewhere.
Well, doesn't hybrid imply that the plant and the slug bred and created this offspring?
I think they all just call that a chimera.
Well, almost. Well, see, that's the thing. They're not quite sure on how the mechanism works. I mean, swapping genes is quite common for bacteria. And some of scientists suggest that maybe it's like some bacterial or virus thing that somehow the genes got mixed while it was in the digestive tract. But it's really bizarre that there are plant genes inside this sea slug.
There's actually a similarly bizarre story that some genetic sequencing found that a large percentage of the human genome is actually exactly the same as a kind of virus, that a virus had incorporated itself into our genome, you know, years and years ago, and that code is still there.
Like 20 years ago, or?
I'm going to say thousands.
Oh, okay.
Maybe even millions.
Well, isn't the universe only 6,000 years old? I was under the impression that it's...
You are incorrect, sir.
Okay.
I have another story. I'm not sure.
What is that story, Rob? I'm sure it's good.
Leaving us in suspense.
I was looking for the citation to tell you what journal it was from, but I can't find it right now. But basically, it was a study in how the framing of a choice can affect your decision. And specifically, it was changing one word in the options that was making a huge effect in how people of different political affiliations were answering the question.
So, do this and die? Would make a difference than do this or not die? Or
it was more to the tune of how people made economic decisions, whether to go with a cheaper option or to go with a slightly more expensive but greener option. And the way they framed the difference was the greener option was either cited as including a tax to help reduce carbon emissions or an offset to do the same. And whether the expensive option was framed as a tax or offset made no difference to left-wing participants. But the right-wingers and independents were much less likely to choose the more expensive option when it was labeled as a tax. And they did some follow-up studies that sort of backed this up. And a final study was testing whether the order of whether the order that you present the options in made a difference. And they, despite the instruction to look at consider the benefits of the green option first, whether it was labeled as a tax or offset, 54% of the right-wingers failed to comply, quoting this article, showing just how averse they were to the tax label. But among the participants who did comply, the effect of looking at the expensive option and considering the impact of the greener option first eliminated the interaction between framing the choice and your political affiliation.
So what basically you're saying is that if you use the word tax versus offset, that your political ideology might play into that because the wording of it's important. And also, if it's the first choice versus the second choice, that will also you'll tend to be more in favor of the first choice than the second choice, irrespective of your ideology. Within certain limits.
Yeah, that's something that cognitive psychologists actually call a primacy effect, that the first item in the list often will be more salient to you somehow.
Cool.
So it looks like the way that you frame a question can actually have a major effect on the decision that you're going to make, which is something to keep in mind.
Hasn't there been research showing this for 50 plus years now? Like, is this just sort of more evidence on it, or is this like brand new?
Well, this particular study is brand new, and I'm not sure it's ever been done with political affiliations before. Plus, it's highly topical with the idea of a green tax or offset. So it's more applicable to real-world dilemmas that are going on right now. But this kind of research that the way you frame a question or the way that you frame a decision can affect your response isn't that new. It's just, obviously, the public doesn't really know about it because perhaps then they would be more suspicious of marketing claims or things that politicians say.
Well, so should we go on with Ethan's topic or should we pay a tax?
Let's listen to my thing.
I'm in favor of that.
Well, actually, you might rather pay a tax than hear this. some news sources have been reporting there is a whooping cough outbreak in the interior of BC. This is taking place in the Kootenays, and there have been 19 confirmed cases of whooping cough, which unfortunately is the result of vaccination rates dropping too low. Obviously, this has been quite a hot topic since H1N1, the vaccine, and then just, you know, Andrew Wakefield's falling out and the sort of reaffirmation of the anti-vax movement. So it is quite a distressing statistic that is coming out of the interior of BC. I'm not actually sure, you know, what the general vaccination levels are across Canada, but I would imagine that, you know, more rural areas are, I guess, a bit lower. Now, this is, I think, particularly unfortunate because the people who are vulnerable to whooping cough are the people who generally can't be vaccinated for it, like infants or elderly or people who have an immune problem like that. So when you don't get vaccinated, you give the virus, or in this case, I guess it's a bacteria, room to spread around. And you endanger the people who can't be vaccinated.
So it's the whole idea of herd immunity, that,
exactly.
that even if you're not at the risk, you can become a host and bring other people and into risk.
That's exactly right. And herd immunity is dropping away, which is unfortunately the case is now among most easily preventable diseases. The vaccine for this one is free, and parents chose not to get it. And now their children...
Do we know if they chose not to get it because of anti-vaccination type concerns?
The story I read did not say that, but I would assume that's got to be a good reason. I mean, just general distrust of big pharma, I suppose, is one of those big things. But
you said this was the interior, right? Because there's a lot of religious fervency in that area.
Yeah,
so it may be a more complex issue than just anti-vax, but definitely anti-vax helps promote it.
I mean, if anything, we've seen the anti-vax movement is very adaptable. It'll find whatever it needs to, you know, get in there.
Much like other crank movements.
Pretty much, yeah. So if you happen to live in the interior of BC, you know, maybe direct your friends and relatives to Radio Free Thinker and help spread some, you know...
That's radiofreethinker.com.
Spread, you know, some good science around, because this can be quite dangerous. I mean, 19 cases may not sound like much, but, you know, if a couple of people die, then it's a serious problem, so...
So don't be afraid of the vaccine. And on that note, we'll go to an ad. And when we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Chris Erickson about the politics of fear.
Robots need love too.
This is Dan Mangan, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 in Vancouver and the surrounding university area.
They want to be loved by robots. Need love too.
And we're back now. As Rob mentioned, going out of commercial, we have a special guest, Dr. Chris Erickson, who is going to talk to us about The Poetics of Fear, your new book.
Yeah.
Tell us about your new book.
I've been working on it for a little while. And essentially, it started out of an idea that I was looking at some language coming out of the Bush administration. So the idea is a few years old. And... you know, sort of long story short, it struck me. I was looking for an answer to the question: is the war on terror inevitable? And I essentially develop a metaphor for spotting fear when it's used. The way that it came about was very interesting. I was actually reading my son a copy of Homer's Iliad.
Oh yeah.
At about the time that George Bush gave his September 20th speech of 2001. And it struck me that the language in both places was almost identical. You know, this told me one of three things. Either Bush had classically trained speechwriters, which he does, or did. Two, that both of them are sort of addressing some universal truth about humankind, which we've kind of run that pathway for a couple thousand years and really hasn't led us all that far. Or three, they're both speaking mythologically. And I decided to pursue that avenue. Using this metaphor that I draw from the Iliad, which is the shield of Achilles, I argue that it makes a double claim. This is the way the world is.
What is the shield of Achilles first, just for those people who haven't read the Iliad?
For the people that haven't read the Iliad, the shield of Achilles is actually a gift from the god of fire to Achilles. And it gets him back into the battle after Patroclus, his friend and some say his lover, was killed. It was, as I mentioned, made by Hephaestus, the god of fire, and brought back down to the battlefield by his mother. And when he received this shield, Homer says that it was so beautiful and so terrifying that nobody could look at it directly except for Achilles himself. The way that it functions in the epic is it's a god's eye view of the world. I mean, you look at the description of the shield, and it's not all that frightening. It's not scary at all. You see a city at peace. You see a city at war. And yet we're told that this thing is terrifying. I ask, you know, why is this so scary? When you look very closely at the language on the shield bleeds into everything else in the epic. Essentially, the message of the shield on the surface looks like, here's a world of peace and here's a world at war. And oh, by the way, you're stuck in the world of war and you're never going to get back to this world of peace. If you look a little more closely at the language, it actually undermines that entire world of peace as well. And you essentially come up with the message, everything is warfare and you're already dead, so don't even bother don't even bother protecting yourself. Because this is a gift of the gods, this is not Achilles saying the world is this way, it's the gods saying the world is this way. So even to have any kind of resistance to this is to be hubristic. It's to go against the word of the gods. We see similar kinds of stuff in certainly out of the Bush administration.
Well, he did talk to God, so...
I think that in the Bush administration, a great example of the use of the shield, and a very, very easy one, is the line, you're with us or you're with the terrorists. And this sets up the double claim of the shield, which is, this is the way the world is, nothing else you can do about it. There's usually the person telling you this has exactly the answer of what you can do about it, of course. And so with Bush's options, what he's done is he's set up basically, follow me or be a terrorist. And you can see this same kind of logic working through the 2004 presidential campaign, which is to say, a vote for anybody but Bush is to be un-American, for example. Dissent is unpatriotic sort of comes out of this same sort of logic. And this logic, the shield as a metaphor operates as a container. It can carry all kinds of messages, not just everything is warfare. It can carry all kinds of messages. You can watch this, you can see this by turning on the TV, watching a couple commercials, you know, buy my stuff or die lonely and alone, right?
But just
same logic.
Yeah, on that same note, just so we don't always kick on Bush, Margaret Thatcher had her famous Tina saying, there is no alternative, which
absolutely.
I think is incorporating the
it's
same idea.
Absolutely the case. As a matter of fact, the book concludes with an analysis of an Obama speech given in March of 2009. And he's using exactly the same logic as well. This is very deeply ingrained stuff. This is not just something that the right would use, or just something that the left would use. It's all over the political spectrum, and it's not just a political tool. It's a very powerful and potent political tool. The one effect of the shield, there's actually, if you go back into the Homeric literature, there's a genealogical relationship of sorts between it and the gaze of Medusa. One of its effects is that it paralyzes you. I mean, if we go back to this statement, you're with us, you're with the terrorist statement, that's a paralyzing sort of a statement. It doesn't allow for you to sit back and say, well, wait a minute, are those my only options? It quite deliberately cuts those out. What I'm trying to do in the book, and using this metaphor, is to identify a number of critical tools that might actually help us when we're faced with a statement like this, say, wait a minute, are those my only options? Is this thing presenting me what it really is claiming to be? Presenting to me, and so that's essentially what I'm doing in the text itself.
So how would you shield yourself from the shield, I guess, is your...
It takes a little while to sort of walk through how you get there, but the one thing the shield always is a representation, and not just any old representation of a reality. It's always a representation of something that is already itself a representation. By that point, you're a couple layers back from the way things really are, whatever that is.
So whoever's making the statement says, this is the reality, but what they're saying is, this is what I think reality might be.
Yes.
As opposed to what...
Absolutely. And it leaves... It's sort of like, this is something like reality is something like.
Okay.
Right? So you're back a couple of layers, which means it's unlike at the same time. It opens up a lot of room to say, rather than sort of being left with the options, you know, this is the way it is, nothing you can do about it, it opens up the possibility of, well, this isn't exactly the way it is, and what can we do about it? What it does is it changes those statements, this is the way it is, nothing we can do about it, into questions, as opposed to statements. There's a particular technique that I sort of look at that helps us do this. There's four, the concept is ekphrasis, which is actually, again, drawn of ancient literature. And the idea is to describe in full, that's how it translates originally. Typically, we use it as poetry describing a work of art. So again, what you have is a verbal representation of a nonverbal representation. And this, again, brings you back that couple of layers where you can say, hey, wait a minute, how is this different? And how does that open up space for things to be different than this? How does that open up for other options?
So if we were going to apply this to some real-world instance, mm-hmm. you mentioned George Bush or whatever. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been a hot topic is terrorism itself, airline terrorism, for example.
Sure.
There was the Underpants bomber, and Gwen Dwyer had a very interesting article. And maybe we can come back to that after a commercial about airline terrorism and bombing.
On the sunny west coast of the nation, this is Kid Koala. And you're listening to CITR in Vancouver on 101.9 FM.
The freshest acts in electronic entertainment are coming to Code Live. 3 weekends, 8 shows in Vancouver's newest multimedia concert space. Friday, February 12th, celebrated DJ Kid Koala brings a special turntable cabaret show to the Center for Digital Media, 3 blocks east of the Main Street Science World SkyTrain station. Montreal's Kid Koala, tickets $22. Call 1-800-TICKETS or tickets.com. Code, it's the Cultural Olympiad's digital edition. For more info, visit vancouver2010.com/CODE.
And we're back now. So, if you remember from before the commercial, we were talking about the Shield of Achilles, politics of fear, and in particular, how that analysis, that analogy that he's used, can be used for something like airline terrorism. Gwen Dwyer wrote an article recently talking about how politicians had to do something about airline security because of the Christmas bomber, even though almost every security person says there's nothing that they can do. They've done more than enough. Canada alone is spending, I think, $11 million on these new, quote-unquote, nude scanners.
And Bruce Schneier called it security theater. And on the topic of these full-body scanners, these nude scanners, never mind the possible intrusion into privacy, but there was a show recently in Russia, I believe, that took the exact model of scanner that they're going to be using and deploying in airports around the country. And they put this guy through it, and he had all the components necessary to build a bomb on his person. And the scanner found his cell phone and his pocket knife and the microphone he was wearing because he was talking on stage. But it didn't find a single component for the bomb. So it's, you know, it seems that at least in this one very striking example, these new expensive scanners aren't actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. And on a further note, there was a study that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security did themselves, and you know, if anyone's going to give a positive review to security features, it's the Department of Homeland Security. Well, they simulated the conditions of an airport security checkpoint and had subjects search through x-rays for weapons, and they give a quick training procedure of what to look for. In one trial, about 50% of the scans had a gun or a knife in the bag, and the subjects did very well, only missing the weapons about 7% of the time. But in another trial, the guns and knives appeared infrequently, only about 2% of the time. This time, subjects missed the weapon 30% of the time. The accuracy went down really sharply, even though the weapon's becoming more rare. And the reason they think that this occurs is because we haven't evolved to search for rare objects. Our probability of finding something will in turn feed back to how quickly you abandon the search for it when you just continually don't find it.
That would seem to have some evolutionary advantages. I mean, why waste your time looking for something you don't quite find?
Exactly. So having these bored security officials who are sitting around entire day searching for something that very rarely happens. When something does happen, they're going to miss it.
So, okay. So let's bring this back now. So, Dr. Erickson, how does fear and politics play in with this whole
security theater?
Security theater, actually. I was thinking about this a little bit. I read the Dyer article, and one of the things that, and I'm not exactly sure if this was a complete non sequitur from the article or not, but that struck me is that this kind of theater has been around for a very long time. It's been around for an extremely long time. During the Cold War, we had a marvelous sort of centerpiece of this sort of public theater of fear, which was the Doomsday Clock, and that has sort of gone away. I mean, the Doomsday Clock, we don't really make so much reference to it anymore. What we have now is this marvelous colored scale of threat levels. And what struck me is that the new model, this sort of multi-colored model, is perhaps better than the clock. In that the clock, you know exactly what's going to happen at, you know, when the clock strikes midnight. You know precisely what's going to happen. When threat levels go to red, what's going to happen? I mean, we just don't know. And so it's that much more frightening. You can kind of make peace with the idea that when it hits 12, we're going to be vaporized. Okay, you can kind of come to terms with that and make it somewhat less frightening because it's comprehensible. A red threat level is designed to be incomprehensible. It's designed, it doesn't say that an attack is going to happen. It doesn't tell you what kind of attack. It doesn't tell you where it's going to happen. It doesn't say any of that stuff. It just says, be afraid, be very afraid. And of course, it also says, but don't be too afraid because don't worry, we got it covered. Just, you know, tag along and we'll show you what to do, right?
Is that, you think, a symptom of what we're afraid of? A terrorist attack, by definition, is sort of unpredictable to a certain extent. We never know when some crazy person is going to decide they're going to blow themselves up.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, like, how do you defend against unconventional threats, so to speak?
Well, it's an age-old question of how do you make sense of the unknown?
Yeah.
And I think that I mean, granted, my background is political theory, and so I tend to come at things from a highly philosophical angle. And it seems to me that one of the things that is, I guess, beneficial about the presence of the unknown is that it can allow you to generate these levels of fear. How to sort of tie this all back together is that by generating these levels of fear, it can keep people more dependent on the people that don't show fear, mm-hmm. or that make a big public show of not showing fear. Look, we're spending all this money on these scanners. We've got it covered, right? You're well protected. Don't worry. I mean, worry, of course, because they're also the ones generating the worry,
right?
Which is partly what these scanners are doing. You see them, you go, oh my God, what's this? I went over to Germany recently and went through the airport in Amsterdam and went through a chemical sniffer. And I'd never been through one before. I was like, wow, what is this thing? And it was a little frightening. It was a little bit frightening at first. So here's this thing that is designed to make me feel more secure, and yet simultaneously it's designed to make me more frightened.
Is it almost like you could use an analogy perhaps of a drug dealer? You know, if you don't have the drug, terrible things are going to happen. But don't worry, as long as I'm here, I'll keep you supplied.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it sets up a level of dependence. I think part of the answer to this is really to become more comfortable with the unknown, to be okay with not knowing. I think that is, I think, part of the answer. Now, how do you do that? I'm not entirely sure. But I think being very wary of any position that says, no, we've got it, this is it, absolutely, you know, end of story. As soon as you can take a stance that you hear that and you go, alarm bell, wait a minute, what's happening here? I think you could potentially be a little less vulnerable to those kinds of theatrics, I think is the best.
And, you know, I think that just goes in completely with the whole idea of our show and skepticism is that, you know, you should take a second to step back and think about what is. People are making claims. Are those claims valid or not? I mean, I think it'll be on our website what are the risks of being attacked with a terrorism, right? I mean, relative to your other risks, they're so insignificant that, you know...
You should be more afraid of driving.
Exactly, you know.
Yeah, well, there's actually evidence that driving can be dangerous, right?
What?
So...
Well, no, and we were talking before about how the $1 billion you're spending on Olympic security. And our Olympics isn't any special. But when you look at other things like the G7 and the Festival of Lights, which are potentially just as big targets for terrorism as anything else, and we don't spend that. And again, it's just because there's this knee-jerk reaction. We have to do this because it might happen, and we just follow along.
And if it does happen, they'll say, well, we should have done more then.
It seems almost self-perpetuating in a way. I mean, people will come up with the idea that, oh, this might be a target for a terrorist attack. Increased security, which draws more attention, more media worry, you know, causing more fear, causing the increase of funding for security, and feedback loop.
Yeah.
You're on your way.
And you're right there when you were saying, Ethan, you know, like, if it does happen, it does happen. But that's the whole, that's the uncertainty thing. Stuff will happen.
Oh, yeah.
One way or another. We just need to be more comfortable with it. Don't be stupid. You know, I mean, don't ignore threats, right? If you,
yeah.
if they said, everyone go on the airline, we don't care what you're bringing on, well, that would be silly, you know? So, I mean, you do need certain levels, but the idea, again, is not to be put into a forced choice situation, which a lot of these fear tactics sometimes puts us into it. Hmm. I think the Olympics should have security. It'd be stupid not to have security.
But yeah. Make sure that the security works, is effective, and isn't causing more problems than it's worth.
So, Doctor, when is that book you mentioned coming out?
It's actually just gone off to press, or it's going to press this Friday. It should be released in May. I'm not exactly sure what the release numbers look like or anything like that, but it should be released sometime in May. It's coming out on Continuum Books.
Did you send Oprah a copy so she could?
Yeah. Don't do that.
Before we run out of time, I'd just like to bring up a skeptic highlight. This coming Saturday is the 2-year anniversary of Vanonymous, which is the anti-Scientology group, or the people who protested. They're having a protest this Saturday at 11 a.m. at Hastings and Homer, or at the Scientology building. I'm not exactly sure where that is.
Look up the show we did on them. It was an hour-long special, and it's a really, really good one. Look at it on our archives on radiofreethinker.com.
That's right. I also want to remind our listeners that tonight is Skeptics in the Pub, and we all know they're at the Railway Club at 7:30, and it's a great time to hang out with your fellow skeptics and have a few drinks. So,
unless you have an essay to write.
Well, nobody has essays to write. Another announcement coming up Saturday, March 20th, it's going to take place at UBC's Victoria Learning Center, is Skepticamp 2010. It's going to be a fantastic non-conference conference.
It's an unconference.
Unconference. Unconferenceable.
What exactly does that mean?
An unconference is where everyone who's participating is also supposed to have something prepared to present.
Yeah, we're going to have speakers, presenters. In fact, our Radio Free Thinker may be presenting as well. But we do encourage everyone who's going to go, please be prepared to ask questions and engage our speakers and vigorous debate. And we do ask you to register early, so please email vancouverskepticcamp@gmail.com. And if you just Google Vancouver Skepticcamp 2010, you'll find the webpage.
I think we're almost out of time.
Right,
in fact, we're going over.
Yeah. Two final announcements, actually. February 23rd is a Tuesday, but you will not hear Radio Free Thinker that day. We are not canceled. We are just temporarily off because of the homeless marathon.
Please listen anyway and donate.
And tune into the webpage, radiofreethinker.com. We may have a special bonus episode available for you. And as talking about bonuses, February 26th, I will be a guest on Skeptically Speaking, and check out skepticallyspeaking.com for more info on that one. Any last-minute announcements?
Only that we're about 2 minutes over time, so it's time to thank Dr. Chris Erickson for coming in and being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and new executive director of CFI, saying so long.
This is Don, saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying, have a good evening.
This is Daniel saying, thanks for listening.
Big government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show/podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science.